More incredible than even a UFO sighting is the fact that the newspaper, once famous for headlines like "Mother Cooks Own Baby and Eats It," was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize this year for its exposure of the John Edwards Love Child scandal. Salacious topics like that haven't been unusual for the National Enquirer, but the recognition of journalistic legitimacy certainly was. What we know as the Enquirer was the brainchild of Gene Pope, who purchased it in 1951. His son, Paul David Pope, tells his father's story and that of his grandfather in his book, The Deeds of My Fathers. It's published by Roman and Littlefield, and I'm glad that it brings Paul David Pope and editor Philip Turner to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Had the Enquirer ever been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize before?
No.
Did that event change your thinking about the book, or had you already written it?
Well, in fact, I think many, many stories from the past. Gary Hart, quite frankly, I think years ago we probably should have been nominated for a Pulitzer. But we always suffered from so much negative recognition and press until finally the Gary Hart was a pivotal point. So I think certainly it was deserving of a Pulitzer for sure.
Well, your original intention, as I understand it, was just to tell your father's story. What led you to expand it to include your grandfather?
The more research I did, it was like the layers of an onion. The more I found out about my grandfather, I realized I couldn't tell the story of my father without my grandfather. My grandfather came over in 1905, 15 years old, didn't speak a word of English, no money, spent his first night on a park bench, and basically ended up building, supplying the sand and gravel that built most of New York City and its landmarks.
Philip, when you were reading this story, were you surprised by some of the revelations, some of the cast of characters?
I was. I was fascinated. Among them, of course, is the mobster Frank Costello.
But there's a whole bunch of mobsters here.
There are indeed, I know. What I loved about it was that it told a hitherto untold story of the way the skyscraper era really blossomed in New York. And who knew that the lowly material of sand dug on Long Island could become the key building block in New York's skyscraper era?
Well, the mobs, it was instrumental in the life and work of both your grandfather and your father. Were you at all reluctant to talk about that, or is this story well known enough so that all you were supplying was some of the more fascinating details?
No, I don't think the story was that well known. And in fact, in telling the story, I wanted to portray an accurate, depiction of these two men.
Your grandfather was born in a small village in Italy. Arpaisa, where is that?
That is inland from Naples, about 2 hours.
So it's some of the people there are proud to be descendants of the Samnites. I'd never heard of the Samnites. Who are they?
Well, I'll tell you, it was an amazing thing. When I did my pilgrimage back to Italy, that was in 2001, truly going back to where my grandfather was from gave me a sense of who I am. And to see the people in the village, to see the quality of life, their values, their ethics. Clearly, these two men, it's just what they achieved was unbelievable.
Well, so many of the Italian immigrants who came over when your grandfather did were from the south of Italy. He grew up on a farm. Was life really tough?
It was. It was tough for him, but, he wanted more. He wanted to strive. He wanted to achieve more. And I think he had a choice. He could stay there or he could come to this country. And what he did is he achieved the American dream. It's a rags to riches, Horatio Alger story.
Well, there was a family called the Capones who had a real influence on your grandfather. Spelt the same way as Al Capone, related in any way?
No.
He imagined that he'd marry into that family. Was that ever a realistic possibility?
I don't think so.
So when he realized that he couldn't, he came to America.
He set his sights differently, yes.
Yes.
So he arrived in the U.S. and he was penniless. How did he wind up working in the sand pits on Long Island?
He was willing to be a menial laborer. He was only 15, but he was strong. And first he carried water in the Pennsylvania Railroad tunnels here on Manhattan, but soon after heard that there was slightly better paying work on Long Island. And so he went out there in Port Washington, and there was this thriving industry already occurring there with families and the sand pit crews.
And a pretty tough environment. Your grandfather had an altercation with the man that led to a court date.
he had many, many tough things and barriers in front of him. And you know, he always, what I admire about my grandfather is he wouldn't stop. He was so driven. He had many altercations. There was a knife fight at one point, a gunfight sort of on the ladder where he fell off and broke his wrist. But he was so driven, he wouldn't stop.
But he didn't meet Frank Costello at the sand pits, did he?
No. He met Frank Costello. Frank Costello was, I think he met, they were probably about the age of 18 years old. This would have been around 1909, 1910. And Frank Costello was doing the shell game. And he was trying to get my grandfather interested in doing it, in which he wasn't.
I mean, being his accomplice.
To some extent, and yes.
Well, Frank Costello was from Sicily, wasn't he? Most of the mafia was from Sicily.
His original name was Francesca Castiglia, mm-hmm. and he and Generoso Sr. were born in the same year. Mm-hmm. And he did already have a thriving kind of numbers business here. And as Paul says, he tried to enlist Generoso in his businesses. But Generoso was already had his sights set on legitimate business, though, as Paul makes clear in the book, was always willing to facilitate the overlap between legitimate business and occasionally illicit business.
Well, was it even possible to work at some of the jobs that were open to Italian immigrants without having to deal with the mob? For example, when he worked on the docks, the mob controlled the docks,
well,
didn't it?
Well, that's part and parcel, yes.
So he had to learn to deal with the culture of bribes.
That's right. And as Paul makes clear in the book, too, he was unwilling to accept a bribe lest his bosses learn of corruption and lose his job. But he was quite occasionally willing to give a bribe. So he had an elastic moral code that we today shouldn't be too quick to judge, because he wanted, as Paul says, he was striving to get ahead.
And he would not have become a part owner of a construction firm if he hadn't had Frank Costello's help.
No.
Frank Costello had moved beyond doing some kind of a Monty scheme.
That's right.
Oh, way beyond that. In fact, at one point, Frank agreed to, with my grandfather, to, with the debt of all the sand and gravel companies, basically just hold them at bay and let him give a chance to take over and repay the debt, of course, which he did. Mm-hmm. And he did it in about a year.
He had to deal with the Irish mob, didn't he? The Gallaghers?
Yes.
Yes, they wanted the Holland Tunnel business, and they were determined to try to get it away from Generoso.
They could have had him killed.
More than once.
Well, were they Many afraid times. Because of his relationship with Frank Costello?
I think Costello was a very effective backstop throughout Generoso's career, either in holding off debts, creditors, or strong arm.
My guests are Philip Turner, an editor with the publishing house.
It's actually a new imprint of mine, Leonard. It's a Philip Turner book with Roman and Littlefield, yes.
And the book is called The Deeds of My Fathers, written by Paul David Pope, how my grandfather and father built New York and created the tabloid world of today. The title, of course, reminiscent of The Sins of My Fathers. And we are talking about sins here as well. Your grandfather got involved with politics and then bought one of the most famous Italian language newspapers in this country, Il Progresso.
He did. He bought it for about $2 million. And he, you know, the newspaper was really kind of like the Bible for Italian immigrants coming over at the time. And clearly he used it also for many different other reasons.
Well, he wanted it for political clout.
Political clout and...
Did he make a big mistake when he admitted his admiration for Benito Mussolini?
I think originally, you know, he didn't know it, of course, but he did. But, of course, after everything happened, you know, he sort of denounced his affiliation with Mussolini.
Although he had met with Mussolini, hadn't he?
Yes.
Oh, he had, twice.
Twice in the years before World War II. And he then is called on the carpet by FDR, who explains that because the fundraising he had done had gone right into the coffers of the Italian government and not to aid, he could be subject to prosecution. And so he was forced to change the editorial staff at Il Progresso.
Meanwhile, he also had a relationship with FDR and Harry Truman. So and we have Mayor, Mussolini, FDR, and the New York mayors.
Jimmy Walker prominently. Paul tells a great story in the book about how the Columbus Day Parade came to be just before the mayoral election of 1929 when he says to Jimmy Walker, you, as it's told in the book, you Patties have a parade. What about us? And soon came the parade.
You know, on the 60th anniversary, my grandfather started the Columbus Day Parade, and he was many times the Grand Marshal.
Was he ever tarnished for his relationship to Jimmy Walker, who wound up going to jail?
Well I think there were a lot of difficult times he had to you know, get through. That being one, but it didn't stop there, as you mentioned, Mussolini. But nothing seemed to squash him. I mean, he was quite resilient and would keep on going.
Well, how did he lose control of Il Progresso?
Well, he didn't. In fact, what so many Italians went back to Italy that emigrated over. He was creating a nice place for them over in this country, and I think that was one of the things he wanted to do with Il Progresso and all the groups he was starting to run.
Harry Truman asked a favor of him after the war.
Yes, Paul tells this great story about how, as a way to rebuild his reputation with Washington, he, Generoso, and Paul's father, Gene Pope Jr., offered to help influence the Italian elections of 1948 with a letter-writing campaign that was conducted through Il Progresso. Right, Paul?
Absolutely.
Didn't the U.S. ask the mob, Vito Genovese and others, to go back to Italy to fight the communists who were taking over the labor unions?
Yes.
So I don't know how involved your grandfather was in that.
He had some involvement. There's no doubt he had some involvement.
And when was your father born?
He was born in 1927.
So he watched much of this.
He was a part of this. And I think he was so entrenched in his father's life that there's parallels in this book that go from generation to generation.
Well, he had older brothers. How come he's the one who his father favored?
Well, it's a very simple. The patriarch of this particular family chooses a favorite son. In this case, it's my father. And in the end, I don't know that it served him that well because, in the end, I think I'll give you this great anecdote. My grandmother was called the general. And,
married to General.
Married to Mike, yes. And she said, to my father, you're the abortion I should have had. Can you imagine? She didn't want my father. I mean, she had typhoid fever, many different things. So I think a combination of sibling rivalry, all these different things, it did not lead to a harmonious environment. So what happened is after my grandfather passed away, they kicked him out of the family business and said, give me the keys back to the company car. And he had to start all over again. And he did. It's amazing that he's and then his story is just amazing as well, as you know.
When your grandfather died, it was a big news story, wasn't it?
Front page story. They closed down Fifth Avenue. It was amazing.
Over 300 firefighters and police were in attendance.
Why was that? I mean, he had this checkered career. Did people forgive all of the past sins? We're talking about mob connections to crooked politicians, support of Benito Mussolini.
I think if you look in totality of what he achieved, he to this day was the most successful Italian immigrant ever of his time. And even though he had some difficult times, he helped so many people and he did so many great things that he was honored by so many people.
He intended for your father to run the business after he died.
Yes.
But that didn't happen.
In fact, he did, and that didn't happen. And in fact, my father was editor of Il Progresso while my grandfather was alive.
Paul tells a great story in the book where Generoso tells young Gene, I want to leave control of this all in your hands. And young Gene says, Pop, I'm going to have to live with my brothers. Don't do that to us. And Generoso decides to do as his younger son prefers. And as Paul says, within a few months of the father's death, Gene is forced out.
I always say it's the story of the century, of this American century, because it spans a century.
And but so there's a lot of conservative politics here. Your father was friends with Roy Cohn. During the McCarthy period. Did he hang out with that kind of crowd?
Well, my father went to Horace Mann. That's where he met Roy Cohn, and in fact introduced Roy Cohn and the judge, Roy Cohn's father, to my grandfather. And they palled around constantly, and they were good buddies, and they did a lot together. In fact, later in the book, of course, Roy Cohn played some interesting parts of many things. In fact, Roy Cohn brokered the deal with for the radio station, WHOM.
Which your father also owned.
Yes.
It became known as the Il Progresso station.
What was interesting, I think, with my grandfather is even with the sand and gravel companies, once he owned Colonial Sand and Stone, he then acquired all the other ones. The same with Il Progresso. He acquired all the other Italian publications. And a similar story WHOM, the radio station.
Your father wound up buying The Inquirer, so he got his own newspaper as well. And did it with the help of Frank Casillo?
He did. It was in 1952. It was called The New York Inquirer. It had a circulation of 17,000 copies.
What did he imagine? Did he think it was going to compete against the News and the Mirror and the Times and the Trib and the Telegram and all those other newspapers?
Well, I think he had a vision, and I'll tell you exactly what he did. Once he took the paper over, he struggled. There was amazing, kiting checks, robbing Peter to pay Paul, great stories of him climbing out of the window to avoid the IRS. His initial thing that he did, Leonard, is that he started putting sports in the paper. The circulation increased a little bit. Then he was driving down the road one day and saw a really bad accident. And persons was decapitated. There were gawkers everywhere. And he had an epiphany, and he said, wow. From that point on, he started running crime and gore. The circulation went to a million copies a week.
Although there were a lot of people who didn't want to carry it, he had a hard time getting it distributed, didn't he? Because distributors were embarrassed by the kind of publication it was?
He did have a hard time, but again, that didn't stop. And he was a pioneer not only of tabloid journalism, but what he did. He put checkout racks at the checkout counters of every supermarket that you're in today. So he revolutionized not only pop culture, but the tabloid world and the supermarkets.
Frank Casillo was brought down. There was the testimony before the Kefauver Committee. And he went to Lewisburg to serve time. Before he did, he came to your father with a request.
Well, he did. And
he wanted a piece of Gene's business. As he had helped Gene, he thought that Gene would be receptive to this.
Well, he had given him money and support.
Yes.
So why wouldn't Gene do that? Because he felt tainted? He would be tainted?
Well, I think in the end, my father said, look, he wanted to cut all ties. He wanted to act in an independent fashion, which he did. He did pay back all this, what he had to, and markers, if you will, and he wanted to disassociate himself.
He did see the Inquirer as an opportunity to even scores and bring some people down. He tried to bring down Judge Samuel Leibowitz, who was one of the most powerful judges in New York.
Yes, it's an unfortunate story that Paul tells about that.
Why did he do that?
Well, Costello wanted him.
So that was as a favor to Costello?
Yes, absolutely.
But it didn't work.
I don't think it turned out quite the way he intended it to.
Was he inspired at all by the British tabloids, News of the World, the Daily Mirror?
Well, the Daily Mirror, I think, for sure. In fact, we had a slogan that after the crime and gore, when we were more celebrity-driven, and we had a slogan, 5 and 75, 6 and 76, 7 and 77.
Those were millions.
Million copies. And, climaxing, of course, with the Elvis issue in 1977. Where we had Elvis on the cover with in the coffin.
Mm-hmm. Elvis became a major headline winner for The Inquirer.
It was our number one issue.
Now, why Elvis and all those issues later where Elvis, there were Elvis sightings even though he was dead?
Well, it's at the end of the book you see where about the Elvis impersonator, and my father would NG, which is no good, you know. I think that just lives on. Elvis is, you know, but I have to say that the one masterful thing my father did is he had this mythical person he wrote to, Missy Smith. And you know, that was a reader he, you know, and to some extent that reader, they couldn't go to Graceland. They couldn't watch the royalty or go to, you know, they lived vicariously through the newspaper.
The newspaper was moved to New Jersey, to Englewood Cliffs, and then later to Florida.
Yes.
Why those moves?
Well, Englewood, I think he wanted to live more of a family life. He wanted to get out of the city. I think he was a little tired of the, you know, the city life, and, you know, he had some problems himself. And Florida, the move
with
there.
With the marriage.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, he had some, you know, difficult times with his marriages. And the ultimate move to Florida, I think he had it so much. I think there were multiple reasons, but he it's very interesting. Here was a man who traveled the world. He essentially became a recluse and a hermit. He didn't travel outside a 17-mile radius, yet he had this innate sense of what the people wanted to read.
There's a scene in the book that could have come right out of The Godfather. It's when Gene is summoned to a meeting with someone referred to as the Godfather. So there actually were people called the Godfather?
Well, that was probably Joe Profaci. you know, to me, I've always said and draw the parallel, it is the Godfather meets Citizen Kane. I mean, if you look at the movie The Godfather, Philip, we were talking about this yesterday, you know, the parallels, it's amazing. And
Gene being the favored, the youngest favorite. Son, the favored one, like Michael Corleone. Mm-hmm.
Well, after then, Frank Casilla was killed. I seem to remember in a barbershop.
Yes.
Did Gene fear for his own life?
I think he did. Yes, there was a time that we had around the clock bodyguards and security. Yes.
And Casilla had tried to give him some help with dealing with his brothers, but Gene decided not to use it.
Well, no, actually, the story in the book that Paul tells is that Costello fed him a nugget about a scam that Gene's brothers were doing with the city, and Gene anonymously gave it to a city attorney.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, anonymously.
To hurt his brothers.
Yes, to damage his brothers, who had forced him out of the business earlier.
One of the controversy about the Enquirer was that it paid for stories. How did Gene defend himself against that accusation?
I don't think he did. It was called checkbook journalism, and, you know, it was paying for stories. And in fact, you know, that's how we got many of our stories. But we didn't pay people to say what we wanted to hear. We paid sources for the truth.
Well, but they always insisted they on always three insisted sources, on, actually more than the two that is standard.
And then sometimes didn't run things. There was a story about Teddy Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne that Gene paid for and then didn't run. And there was he sat on a story about Henry Kissinger as favors to those people?
Well, let me paint this a little bit depiction. My father was in the CIA. He graduated MIT in 2.5 years, so he wasn't the stereotypical tabloid owner. In fact, he was in a division called Psychological Warfare, which my grandfather started right around the letter-writing campaign in 1948. So quite an interesting history. And
well, we've run out of time, but I'm curious about your relationship to the paper.
After my father passed away in 1988, I tried to get the paper. I didn't get it, and I have no affiliation or relationship with the paper anymore.
But meanwhile, you tell this fascinating story, and you don't want to go in the newspaper business?
You never know. I have a few more books I'm going to do, I think. And
if they sell well, maybe you can buy yourself a newspaper. Meanwhile, the Enquirer seems to have had a real impact. Used to be considered an embarrassment. Now it's probably a model for an awful lot of so-called legitimate newspapers. The book, The Deeds of My Fathers, How My Grandfather and Father Built New York and Created the Tabloid World of Today, written by Paul David Pope, also with us, editor Philip Turner. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.